Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 11th, 9/1/2002. This session is Pros and Cons, a Perfect or Rational God, or both. We'll listen in to Janine Diller Murphy as she explores this topic. So why don't we start and listen in.
Let me just say a bit about what I want to do today is to say a bit about last time, just for people who weren't here, so you kind of are in on the discussion. Is there anyone who wasn't here before? Okay, then I'll do that. And then say a little bit about why I care about this stuff, sort of my personal journey. And then move into some of the reasons, biblical sort of reasons for thinking the way that I think, which was for me a turning point in my path towards where I ended up. What we talked about the last time, what in general we're trying to talk about is who God is, or another way of saying, because I come from the Judeo-Christian tradition, I'm trying to figure out who the Judeo-Christian God is. In other words, what's a good way of understanding who this being that I say is the most important being in my life is. Okay. And the usual view about this is called perfect being theology, which can be said very simply. This being is, the being that is God is the being who is absolutely perfect. And what it takes to be perfect, the usual view, which has been in the works for a couple thousand years, is that it takes omnipotence, what I call the omnis in the end, omnipotence, which is being all-powerful, omniscience, which is being all-knowledgeable, omnipresence, which is being all-present, omnibenevolent, which is being all-loving, and then the ends are immutability, which means not changing and not, in fact, being able to change, impassibility, which is not being affected by anything, impeccability, not being able to sin, incorporeality, the ends and the ends, not having a body, and then there's a few others. But so you guys get the idea that those long list of alleys, the omnis and the ends, are supposed to be the equipment it takes to be perfect. And on the usual view, that's what it is to be God. On the view that I was introducing last time, which is called relational theology, and has just been recently developed by me in my dissertation. And so it's not famous at all, it doesn't have a long history. I want people who were here last time and got this super complicated handout to forgive me for the super complicated nature of the handout. And just remember this. that on my view, what it is to be God is not to be perfect, but rather to be the being who does a good amount of this stuff. Create the universe, provide moral support that is either instruction and or help in following the moral path, as one clear example of that is the Ten Commandments. Providentially care for the world, meet people in religious experience, and be worthy of our worship, prayers, trust, and love. In other words, all this stuff are these relations. You might think of them as divine relations. I affectionately sometimes call them divine jobs. And if you do this kind of stuff, enough of it, then that's what it means to be God. Questions about that so far?
And Janine, when you say God is not perfect, you're referring specifically to that definition.
To the omnis
and the ends.
So, right. And the reason that, so what I haven't said yet is God is not perfect. I've said this is a positive picture. This is who God is.
Yeah.
Now, the interesting surprise in my research, at least for me philosophically, and it took about 50 or 60 pages to prove this, is that it doesn't take the omnis and the ends to do this stuff. That is, you can do all these things, which I take to be sort of religiously really important, and not be perfect in the sense of the word perfect that's been at work in the tradition, philosophically and theologically anyway, for the last 2,000 years. So that's interesting so far. Okay. And I think those are two claims that I don't even want to say maybe by. I think this is really the right way to go, from my opinion. Again, all this class is in my humble opinion, okay? Now here's the part where I'm going to say maybe. If this is what it means to be God, doing some of this stuff, at least a good portion of this stuff, and it doesn't take the perfections, the omnis and the ends to do that stuff, well then, maybe God doesn't have them. Maybe God doesn't have the omnis and the ends. And the reason I say a maybe is because, well, maybe God's just overqualified. Maybe God does have them and just has all this kind of extra knowledge and power that turns out God doesn't really need, can go above and beyond the call, right? Could have done more, but just did this, at least in our world. Maybe there's other universes or other beings in some other realm God's taken care of in different ways, and that's why we only see a piece of the power and the knowledge here, right? So you could believe that God is perfect. God does have the omnis and the ends, and still think, well, what I mean when I say the word God is this, I mean to talk about this person that does this stuff in our world. And I know that, you know, you could do that with less, but it turns out God has total power and total. Okay. So maybe God's overqualified. But I think the interesting point for me is that this leaves open the fact that it's possible God doesn't have the omnis and the ends because God doesn't need them. So God could have them, maybe he does, but maybe he doesn't. And that's something you simply can't say if you're a perfect being theologian. Because to say that God is not perfect if you're a perfect being theologian is out of bounds in the same way that if I were to say a triangle doesn't have three sides, right? A perfect being theologian, if I were to say that God's not perfect, would sort of be charged with not even understanding what the word God means. Right. Like my little cousin Luke, who said, I'm a vegetarian, and then proceeded to order ham. It was like, you don't have the concept, right? You don't know what it is to be a vegetarian if you're ordering ham. And so in the same way, sometimes when I talk to perfect being theologians, they might say something like, well, you don't understand what it is to be God if you don't think God's perfect. What I've tried to do is to provide a robust theory on which it's possible to meaningfully say that God is not perfect, because this is what I mean by the word God, and it turns out you don't have to be perfect to do that stuff. Is that clear? Is that a little easier yesterday? Any questions about that? Because that's the view. I haven't yet given you any reason to believe this view, okay? I've just tried to tell you what the view is, but you don't have any reason to think I'm right yet. Okay, but any questions about what the view is? Okay. So, let me just say a little bit about my personal story that kind of made me interested in all this. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio. Mike said, just talk about the relevant stuff, and then here I tell you where I grew up.
Well, that explains a lot, Jenny.
Yeah. That's a weird place. Because I know this is kind of a different kind of view, and I just want you to understand how I got here, at least as far as I understand it. So my parents were missionaries in Africa before I was born, and I grew up in an evangelical community Westgate Chapel, and it was a Christian Missionary Alliance church, and that's where I started out for the first 18 years of my life. And I think my dad always hoped I would be a missionary. I don't know what my mom thought about that. But basically, I've been praying as long as I can remember. God has been in my psyche as long as I can remember. But somewhere along the way, I started having doubts. And I guess just a little family background, I guess the rest of my family did too, because I have four siblings and three of them don't believe in God anymore. Two of them are straight out atheists and one of them is an agnostic. So, which has caused a lot of grief for my parents, as you might imagine. But I think with this kind of background, and there was a need in my family to understand where you stood on God. And we all took positions by about age 10 or 11. So it was very troubling and difficult for me when I started having doubts of my own about God, since I had taken this position as a faith person. My whole life revolved around the church, and a lot of my emotional support came from there. And so I came close to having a nervous breakdown my senior year in high school over this issue, and ended up at Wheaton College, which I had applied to when I could still sign on the dotted line that I was a Christian, and which I still wanted to go to because I understood that there was a place where I could think about God, whereas where I had grown up was only a place I could feel about God. And every time I asked a question, I was told I shouldn't be doing that and that I should have faith. And when you're a person with questions, that's a pretty hard answer to take. And I still feel guilty about having questions, even though now it's become kind of part of my occupation to try to answer them. I went to Wheaton and found that it was a place that I eventually could think about faith, although there weren't a lot of other travelers on that road with me there, except in the philosophy department where I ended up after some time. And was just overjoyed to read other people for centuries who've been asking these questions and trying to figure out who God was and whether God existed or not. So I came to philosophy from a very personal need and was very met there in many ways, and so it's a very valuable part of my life to me. I went to grad school and ended up feeling disillusioned with philosophy for a while and left and did work in politics and community work, and then felt that I didn't want to leave these questions behind, but there was a part of me that had felt like it was dying in this other work that I just needed to keep alive for some reason, and thought, well, I'll come back and try to do both things. try to make a career out of philosophy enough that I could still think about these questions that seemed so helpful to me, even though none of the answers had been that satisfying. And I don't know, I guess the reason that I came to this topic was kind of philosophical, because in this world that I was involved in, everybody assumed perfect being theology, and everybody was pretty familiar with the many problems that philosophical problems that arose from that view, which I kind of alluded to. But there's some logical problems which everybody kind of just laid out for you. I mean, I went to University of Michigan, where at Wheaton they told me they ate Christians for breakfast, which was not really true. I was happy about that, but there. I was quite alone in the faith there, I can say that much. And so these problems were, some people took very seriously and didn't believe in God because of them. And there's also the problem of suffering, which we talked about briefly yesterday, which I think is harder for a perfect being theologian to deal with than for me to deal with. So anyway, there was sort of this philosophical background for sort of taking me to this place. And I think there's been some personal impacts after having kind of, well, in the process of arriving here and being here, that I wanted to tell you about. And one of them, I guess, is, and maybe this is something I just thought of this today, but I was realizing that I guess I feel like I'm engaged in the kind of work that I hope the church does. I think that there's a strong need for the church to be very creative with what they're committed to, never giving up on what they're committed to, but being careful and creative about what's essential to what they're committed to, so that you have some options available for people. Because I think part of the reason that my family members don't believe in God is because nobody was creative and nobody was even talking about the questions and about the nature of God. So I hope to be involved in this kind of larger project of really being alive in our thinking about the doctrine of the church. So that's kind of a personal stake. Something else that's kind of happened for me in moving to this view is, I guess I've always taken God to be a moral standard, kind of an example to follow. And I guess I hadn't quite realized this before, but before coming to this view, but perfect being theology, that standard is kind of abstract. This is something that Alicia kind of mentioned yesterday, but when you're striving, when who you understand God to be is this omnipotent being, and that's supposed to be your moral goal, there's a sense in which you're striving for this kind of perfect track record, and our too frequent failures to reach that track record are sort of just constant disappointments on our moral path. And it's also not even clear always what it means to be totally good, or as knowledgeable as you can be, or as powerful as you can be. I guess the thing that's nice about this for me is that I feel like there's sort of a nice concrete list of activities that God undertakes, and that if God, this God, is your moral standard, then the idea is that your life or your moral work is about being creative. You're not going to create the universe, right? But you are creating a world around you every day, people that are in your path. And the idea is to create a beautiful world around you and to be supportive morally for other people, and to care for other people in the best way you can, to meet them in a true experience of a meeting of selves, to be worthy not of their worship, I guess that's a place where there's something of difference here, but and not of their prayers, but to be worthy of people's trust and love, and to be in that kind of relationship with people. So for me, I guess it's just provided a kind of, I don't know, just an active sense of what it is that we're supposed to be doing here on Earth. If what it is that we want to be doing is to be like God, because this is who God is, and so to be like God is to be engaged in these kinds of activities. I should stop for a second. any thoughts?
Is that your complete list, or would you say there might be some others that you would add to that?
Well, I guess the more complete list is on the complicated handout from yesterday. And then there's an even more complete list in the dissertation, and then there's an even more complete list that didn't make it into the disc.
Yeah, the only reason I say that is because I think sometimes when Paul is quoted, you know, in Romans and 1 Corinthians, it's not his complete list. He's saying these are some of the ways, I think, and there's more. And we often limit it to that, and you're not limiting to this.
No. I would be happy if you wanted to be more complete.
Yeah.
Good. Other comments at this point or thoughts? Okay, so another thing that I kind of alluded to yesterday is that thinking this way is kind of helping me understand where suffering comes from, or where suffering might come from a little more, and that's where I might be more inclined to just say, I don't know for sure whether, I was thinking about this today, maybe philosophy is all about guessing, and educated guessing. I guess I don't think that's bad. I guess I had a student once who said, aren't you supposed to be making like claims like, this is the way it is? And only when you know that that's the way it is. But if you don't, maybe you should just say, well, this is the way it might be. And I guess I find it encouraging to have stories of possibilities or possible reasons God might have or possible issues that might make it that 9/11 happened when you're trying to tell a story to yourself about how there can be a God and how that terrible thing could happen. It's good, I think, to have some possibilities there that even if you don't know that's the way it is, at least there's something you could think of that might make sense. So this is where I would probably, with the problem of suffering, I find myself drawn to saying, maybe God doesn't have the omnis and the ifs, and so God literally couldn't solve or couldn't stop 9/11 from happening. That would be one example. And maybe God could have done it if we had all been more involved, if we had all been doing more of this kind of living, if we had all been really caring for the rest of the world, really listening to the kind of people like Osama bin Laden. Not that we want to pander to him, but I think that there are true roots of injustice that have probably made him able to become as powerful as he is. He has a pretty big force out there. So, I don't want to get too political and this thing's not relevant here, but anyway, I guess the problem of suffering sort of, it's still a problem, but there's easier ways to answer it when you become a relational theologian, in my view. You want to talk about that more?
Do you guys have
guys are really quiet tonight. Mm-hmm. I said something awful. Or...
Can I ask a question?
Yes, please do.
I should somehow be able to think through, but I don't know how to.
Okay, that's fine.
Who wrote something about theology of glory and theology of the cross? Is that Luther?
Luther's theology would be theology of the cross, not theology of glory. Theology of glory comes out of other writings.
Well, theology of glory is counter-reformation theology. It's the Jesuit militant missionary effort to get people back that they lost to Protestantism. Mm-hmm. And so the church asserts itself triumphantly. It builds big buildings. It makes lots of saints, lots of paintings. It celebrates gold and silver and power and wealth and all those things. And I wonder if that goes with the alms and the hymns, mm-hmm. and you sort of build the church on that model. And then in the theology of the cross, you talk about God as a loser, you talk about despair, about rejection, about a bag of skin taken down off the cross that's full of junk. I mean, yeah. And in a counter-reformation deposition from the cross, Christ comes down off the cross, but he's still on the power figure, just dynamite, like Superman.
Huh.
And you can't overpower him. But in the Lutheran view, that God is really an abject, hopeless mess. And I wonder if that fits more on the relational side. And because it's more human and it's more fits our roles, mm-hmm. in some of these things you talk about, helping people.
Right. But
I don't know if that's connected to all of this or not, but omniscience and omnipresence and omnipowerful seems like theology of glory.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting observation. I've never thought about that. I mean, certainly sounds like my view can handle the theology of the cross better. What's the second title? The theology of...
Glory?
No, the first one, or the other one.
The cross.
Okay.
Luther writes about that.
The theology of the cross better than perfect being theology can, because it's a puzzle how God can be on me and in and still be a bag of flesh coming down from the cross. Whereas on my view, there's room for understanding how that could be. The flip side of that, though, is that the theology of glory, which I think represents a really important religious emotion, if nothing else, that you feel when you worship, that perfect being theology does better on that score than my view does. Because there's a sense in which, on my view, when you're worshiping, I think worship is kind of a sense of like, wow, you're the best, you know? But on my view, you'd have to kind of say, wow, you're good enough.
The last piece we sang this morning had more a sense of, well, a lot of it was minor, and then there was a little positive triumphalism at the end of it, but it really was a gut-wrenching song, mm-hmm. Out on the ark. It felt like pain. And we weren't celebrating anything. I can't remember the words. But I think we're going to sing it again tonight.
Okay.
But it had a lot of that kind of cross feeling about it.
Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts from other folks? Yeah.
Kind of taking off on that, something that until a few years ago always really bothered me is, if God was all these omni-ims, why did God need to go through this whole thing, having a Jesus that comes to earth and, I mean, poof, the relationship is restored and everything's okay if God's omnis and ims. And so that was something that always troubled me, and where, you know, 5 years ago, it was about relationships.
Mm-hmm.
wasn't about God being on these limbs. It was about God loving God's people. And so maybe God is on these limbs, but God doesn't choose to be on these limbs. God chooses to be a God of relationships. Mm. And so what you're saying very much resonates for me with that. And, it doesn't matter whether God is or isn't on these limbs. It's that God chooses to be in relationship with God's people. And perfection is not... Well, we all have friends who are a little more perfect than me, and it's really hard to have a relationship with those kind of people. So I think this resonates very well.
I think it also resonates well with sort of, you know, work out your faith with deeds and like you said yesterday, in some ways, if that God in a sense needs us to be Christ's in the world in order to make the world what it could be. And if, like this woman said yesterday, that's our role, and we're doing those things that you just talked there in relational theology, then God's power is released. But it's released less powerfully or less possibly if we're not becoming that way.
Right.
And it does seem that a lot of things that you read in the scriptures are like that, you know. God is asking us to participate in the process.
Yeah, exactly.
And it doesn't happen without us.
Exactly. And so there's a sense in which the other thing this has really done for me is to increase my sense of personal responsibility to be active in the world.
Yeah.
And also increased my, I guess, my sense of how important prayer is, because I think that's one way in which we are active. I don't know, here's another guess, and this one is even more speculative, I think, but sometimes you get this feeling like God, like if you think about the Lord's Prayer, where it says, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Why does God need us to say something like that? Right? And I get this sense that it's almost like God has some rule, like, I'm not going to be involved unless you ask me to be involved. I'm not necessarily going to be present with you unless you, two or three of you, gather together and ask me to come. I mean, you need to ask me to be present in this world, and then I'll give you the power to do things in my name. I mean, I really do feel that prayer might be our invitation to have God in the world with us in a very meaningful, real way. And that if we're not active in prayer, and we're not active in trying to live out the Christ-like and God-like role, that the world can just go to pot. And that's why maybe things like 9/11 happen. Again, this is speculation, but this is kind of my way of understanding right now the problem of suffering based on what I've learned so far. Yes, my friend.
God gave us choices.
Yeah.
He didn't say, you have to believe in me.
Right.
He says, if you believe in me, you'll enter the kingdom of heaven. Simple, isn't it? I think it's so simple. It boggles my mind to think that God, if I believe in God, that I'll go to heaven. But he gave us some guidelines along the way, the Ten Commandments. And we all fall short of these Ten Commandments. A lot of religions like to throw a guilt trip on us. You know, you better be good, better do this, better do that, if you want to go to heaven.
Right.
That ain't what God said. He said, but if you believe in God, you'll try to do what God wants us to. I said try.
Right.
I didn't say we would.
Right.
Yeah, are the artists way off base with the philosophers, or the being is out there or beyond or infinite or something like that?
Yeah. Well, this is okay. So I took one Greek philosophy course. The rest of this stuff I learned through my dissertation. But what I can tell you they believed that the cosmos around them was more perfect than the world itself. And it sounds to me, so like they looked up at the stars and they saw the stars and thought that they were beautiful, they also thought they were fixed. This kind of leads to the immutability of God, because they thought that the things above them would never change, and in that sense weren't subject to the sort of problems of change that we all experienced on Earth, and in that sense they were more perfect. And they also thought that they were eternal and unaffected by the little things that happen down here, so impassable. And so they saw all this above them, and they kind of made this huge, especially Plato, made a huge distinction between the perfection of the spheres and the imperfection of the body here on Earth. And this was sort of the beginning of the fear of the body in Christian thought, which wasn't really broken until Aquinas, who's somebody really lovely. I just have to say this because I think this is so hilarious. This person said, it wasn't until Aquinas that we were able to take our bodies lightly. Anyway, it sounds to me, maybe, from what you just said, that maybe the artists were attempting to create the kind of perfection they saw above on Earth through art. Does that sound possible? I don't know, but a fear of infinity, that sounds different.
But they, and their temples were filled with all these various gods, so maybe they weren't that far along.
Yeah, well, maybe they were hired by the people who believed in those gods.
Yes.
Okay, great.
I just have a question, Janine, that has to do with what the Lutheran, what ELC Church believes, and I don't want to get a long dissertation about what the Lutheran Church believes, but we are in the Lutheran place. I'm not from a Lutheran background, nor am I currently involved in the Lutheran Church, but can anyone give me a pithy understanding and statement about God?
You mean about the Lutheran God?
No. Okay, the Lutheran God. Yeah. I mean, I grew up with a creed. I think we have the Apostles' Creed. We have the things that we grew up as our creed, but I'm just wondering if there is a controversy present or some disagreement with what we've had, what would be the basis and what is the kind of the two or three lines that the ELCA Church would say about God?
I believe that God created me and all that exists, but I don't know what the next line is. What is the next line?
Which are you talking about, the creed itself?
But Jesus
Christ created me and all exists. He gives and still preserves my body and soul and all its members. And talks about a providential God in the second part, and in the end that we have a responsibility to give thanks, praise, and glory to God for what He has done. So.
Wow, it sounds really congenial.
I got a D in confirmation.
I did too. That's why I became a pastor, so I could memorize everything. Kids, I finally got it. So. 35 years. What's the problem with God? I think God in all religions is the highest power that we all are obliged to acknowledge, period.
Excellent.
The difference for us as Christians is that we believe that God loved us so much He would not let us despair over our sense of lostness and sends His own Son, or I believe that God became a person in Jesus Christ.
Right.
And to show us the way is not the way. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. And He talks about Himself being the light. He becomes that kind of a model for us. But in Christ, we also see the stuff that you've been talking about, relational. I love you so much that I'm even willing to die for you. You're so stupid you don't get. You're going to kill me, but I'm still going to allow you to do that because I love you so much. And so suffering, death, and resurrection have to be a part of our understanding of who God is. And this whole issue about suffering, I mean, it's a part of life.
Right.
God does not, I know there's passages about prayer and, you know, it'll relieve all this stuff, but I see more that God has promised to be with us in all of our circumstances, mm-hmm. and the more often we can be in tune with God,
right.
the more apt we will be to doing God's will.
Yeah.
There's a, I've been looking all the while you've been talking, I don't know if this helps at all, but in Ephesians it says, God has made us what we are, and in our union with Christ Jesus, he has created us for a life of good deeds, which he has already prepared for us to do. Now, the Almighty God doesn't say, if you don't do those deeds, you're going to go to hell. A couple of days ago, we read in a devotional about, the phrase was divine appointments. And it seems to me that when I'm really listening in my heart and I do something that connects me with somebody else, that's maybe that divine appointment, that I experience God's presence. Most of my life is whatever.
Right.
The issue with the bombing of the towers, those guys did not understand God.
Right.
And they were deceived by some leader. God cannot interrupt that. And like, I agree with you, we failed many, many years ago to evangelize the world with goodness and mercy and peace and all of that. The Christian church has been a part of the most vicious activity in the world, you know, to go out and what we did. But anyhow, I think there were divine appointments that occurred in the bombing of that tower. Men called their wives on cell phones from the airplane. They did the same. There were people that ministered to people in the midst of the building going down.
Mm-hmm.
That's where God was. But God would not stop us. God will not stop terrorists. We need to deal with that. We need to deal with the issues that cause terrorism.
And maybe God will help us.
Yeah.
If we pray and ask for God's presence and power.
Yeah. Not on our own, we can't do it. Right. I think we'll make just as many mistakes trying to be good for the wrong reason.
Right. This is Dale's stuff.
Okay.
But,
is that an answer about God? I'm sorry, you said three sentences. It's impossible to give the floor to a Lutheran pastor.
Well, maybe I shouldn't ask the question without stating where I'm coming from. I'm not a scholar or a theologian. I just always grew up with the idea that God is this perfect being. I wanted that standard,
yeah.
that God, my God, was perfect. Mm-hmm. And now this week sort of shaking it up a little bit, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
Wait, let me shake it up a little more.
Be my guest.
Okay, so we have 10 minutes. You guys are fine?
Were there more handouts?
Well, you can share one up here.
Thanks. Okay.
Thank you.
I don't want to cut anyone off, though. Yeah.
Is it possible that God is perfect, but sometimes chooses not to be?
Ooh. That is actually a theory of a guy named John Bishop. And he's a wonderful guy from Australia. He's a good company. Well, John Bishop actually said that he wonders if God was, say, omnipotent. Let's just focus on the power aspect. And gave up his power so sometime after creation, so that he wouldn't interrupt us in our process of trying to become true humans and loving, learning how to love each other. So there's a view where there could be sort of a yes and no to the question, is God perfect? Yes, he was, but not anymore. So, yeah.
And maybe even a little bit harder to swallow, but along those same lines, that maybe God is perfect and that we are just too darn human to understand that perfection.
Mm. Yeah, now this gets to the question of what is perfection anyway?
Yeah.
And how we got it right in terms of the omnis and the ims. I mean, if somebody wanted to define perfection as creating the universe and providing moral support. So it really does matter how you define perfection.
Right.
And I think you're right. We may not be doing that well.
I was just thinking in terms of suffering that how many times have we on smaller scales than 9/11 or whatever larger scale suffering come away from the suffering and looked back and said, wow,
mm-hmm.
that was the right thing that needed to happen at the time. And then,
right.
you know, maybe this, as tragic as it has been, 9/11, maybe that was the perfect event for the time to spur some growth toward, I mean, I don't know what the perfection in it was, but.
Yeah, the real problem, though, are the pieces of suffering where it just looks like no good comes out of it. And I'm sure we can all think of something like that in our lives, where it's just tough to see, even at the end of your, I haven't reached maybe long enough in my life, but that'll be a real issue.
But now that you're off track, my impression of philosophy, you said one of the reasons you're questioning this is because of the inconsistencies that philosophy finds. Mm-hmm. My impression of philosophy is that almost anything I would say, if not everything, they can find some inconsistency with it, that philosophy has grown to the point of just questioning everything. Can we know? Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. We can't. We believe. So.
Actually, this is a little shocking, but nobody has ever found a way to find that inconsistent. And I have four minds you wouldn't want to meet in a dark alley. So, I don't know. Maybe you're right. But I actually, maybe I have a little more faith in philosophy than you do about it. But, you know, I think it would be tough to show that inconsistent.
Okay.
But I'm still open to finding somebody who might do it, but anyway. The other view, I mean, there are 30 reasons I read for thinking a perfect being theologian is inconsistent. I don't think all of them work, but I think there's a couple stumpers in there. Yeah.
I think 9/11, there was some good that came out of it, because I think it drew us together a little more.
Definitely did. I don't
think realized we're not infallible. Mm-hmm. You know, this can happen to us. We've never been attacked in our own country. We've always attacked in other countries. Mm-hmm. And it's not a happy scene.
Yeah.
No matter where it's at.
I think that's right.
And I think it has drawn people together rather than separated. So maybe there was some good, and maybe we had to be awakened. And it's a tragedy, but
yeah.
I don't know what God's theory was on it, but
we'll be talking more about 9/11 on the phone.
Yes.
So, but I think, you know, there could be a gift, as Dale would say, in 9/11. All right. Yeah, Mike.
I'm just wondering what you wanted to get to.
Well, I wanted to tell you guys the biblical story, but it's a quarter till, which I guess means it's the end of.
Can you give us a little bit?
Do you guys want a little bit?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, great. We have 10 minutes.
Do we? Okay.
15 minutes.
Okay. We have 15.
Well, anybody, don't feel rude if you need to go, okay? But I'll just tell you what I found out. This was all really surprising to me, and also it was very handy, but I had a dissertation to write. But actually, if you find something different, when you go look in your concordance, tell me. Because I'm hoping to publish about this. So, all right, here's what I found. First of all, I wanted to figure out with perfect being theology, does the Bible say God is perfect straight out? I mean, is there a place where it says God is perfect? Well, there are 11 places that associate perfection with God. But there's 154 places altogether that use the word perfection in association with something. Okay? So it's not only God who's associated with perfection, but lots of people, like Noah and Asa, did I say that right?
Asa,
Hezekiah, Job, a lot of sacrificial animals are perfect. Grapevines are perfect. The cities of Zion and Tyre are perfect. Okay, so what I'm trying to tell you here is that the word perfect is used pretty freely in the Bible, at least in the King James Version. Now, the 11 instances that are associated with God, they're both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and they say things like God's way is perfect, just like Noah's way was perfect. The words that are being used there, there's only one, I guess I'll start with this, there's only one that says that God is perfect straight out, and that's Matthew 5:48, which says, "Be ye perfect even as your Father in heaven is perfect." You guys are probably familiar with this. It turns up in the same chapter as the Beatitudes. Even just at a first glance, you can probably tell that Jesus is not saying, "Be ye therefore omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent, immutable, even as your Father in heaven is these things, right? In other words, even at first glance, it doesn't look like the kind of perfection at issue here is the same kind of perfection that perfect being theologians are saying God has. And when you look at the Greek word, it's teleos. This is kind of scary to do in front of a pastor.
He's looking it up right now.
Yeah, all right.
Same in these English versions.
And the word that's perfect in these other places that are in the Old Testament is generally tamid. Both of these words have a wide variety of connotations. Perfect is among the connotations, but in the case of tamim, which is the word of the Old Testament, that's the Hebrew. Do you guys want me to write any of this down, tamim? Okay. That one, other connotations include intact and honest. So there's a wide variety of meanings there. And that's why you can see how it gets applied to things like grapevines. Like the grapevine is still intact. It's one piece. And teleos has also several connotations from mature, full-grown, sort of complete. So the word perfect, given these connotations, you tend to get a sense that it's not going to be the omnis and the ends. It's going to mean something else. And when you look verse by verse, let's just focus on Matthew 5:48. I think Jesus must be meaning, well, there's a parallel passage in Luke. You can probably tell me chapter and verse, Luke 6 something, where instead of saying, be ye therefore perfect, even as my Father in heaven is perfect, it reads, be ye therefore merciful, even as my Father in heaven is merciful. The same story gets told in a different way with a different adjective. And I guess I tend to think that what Jesus is doing here is trying, it's right after turn your other cheek, that part. I think Jesus is asking us to be totally giving to the people around us and compassionate. And the Anchor Bible translators think that he's saying something close to that. I have all these different... let's not get into too much detail. But anyway, the clearest verse for saying that God is perfect is Matthew 5:48. And I think it's obvious both from context and from the meaning of the Greek words that it doesn't mean be therefore omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent. Okay, so the case for saying that God is perfect is pretty weak in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, the case for saying that God is omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent is a little stronger, I think. Interestingly, those very words don't turn up in the King James Version, except for once. The only passage where you find any omni or in used in the Bible, in the King James Version, is Revelation 19:6, which is the same one that comes up in the Messiah. the Lord God omnipotent reigneth. And no omniscient, no nothing anywhere else. And that translation goes away, and even when you look at the New Revised Standard Version and the Revised Standard Version, you don't see any omnipotent even in Revelation 19:6. So there is no omni or in stated in the Bible. Now, and check your concordances and tell me if you come up with something different. But what you do come up with are phrases that sound a lot like what you would think omnipotence and omniscience mean. So you have Job saying God can do everything. You have Paul saying God knows everything. You have the phrase all over the Bible, God Almighty. Right? And so, sure, the omnis and the ends themselves aren't stated directly, but there are lots of passages that make you think that God has those properties. Here's what I want to say about those. Most of them, and not all of them, and so I'm admitting that there are some verses you can throw at me that would be against my view if I were to go as far as saying maybe God doesn't have it. Okay. There are verses I can throw the other way, though. But most of them occur in poetry or rhetorically charged contexts. So a lot of them you'll find in the worship parts of the psalm, where I think it's totally natural for an artist to want to kind of go to the max in order to create the religious emotions that they're trying to create. They also occur in sort of strained emotional contexts. So you hear Job saying, God can do everything, only at the end of the entire ordeal when God finally meets him in the whirlwind. And you're not sure if he's angry at God, or you're not sure exactly, he's just been through a lot, right? And God has just kind of scolded him, saying, here's the tab. Were you there when I made the earth? Were you there when I did this? Were you there? And then Job finally just says, God can do everything. So I think it's one of those contexts where the emotion is pretty high. The need to say God can do everything is pretty high. So that was rhetorically charged, I think. And for example, another example is when Paul is really exasperated. After Jesus has asked him a third time, do you love me? He says, you know I love you. You know everything, right? Again, it's this one of these contexts where it's sort of like arduous. And he just has to come out and say, you know everything. Come on. So in my view, these statements about the omnis and the ims never turn up in these kind of quiet contexts where somebody says, who is God? What you end up hearing in answer to something, God, and you can tell me more about this, but I never came across a passage when God introduces him or herself to somebody, where God says, I am the omnipotent one. Rather, God says, like to Moses in the time in Exodus, when he's meeting Moses and saying, Moses says, tell me who you are. God says, I am slow to anger. I am abound in loving kindness and faithfulness, right? And he talks in terms more like this. So I guess I just don't think the omnis and the ims occur in contexts where anybody's trying to be really careful about who God is. They occur in contexts where people are kind of drawn to emotional responses. And the other thing is, think about the context that they're in. There's a bunch of gods out there, right? Or at least people think there's a bunch of gods out there. And there's this need to kind of make your God better than the other God, to kind of keep up with the Joneses. And so you find, like, Augustine talking in this really odd Latin term, omnipotentissimus, which is, I want to talk to you about the most omnipotent thing. Not all those other omnipotent things that all those other people talk about. I want to talk about the most omnipotent thing in order to distinguish his God from all the other gods that people say are omnipotent. So there's strong cultural pressures to use this kind of language as well. So I just don't think a lot about, there's more of a case for the omnis and the ims than there is for perfection, but that case is kind of weaker than you might have thought it would be. And there are cases that, certainly against the ims, that make you think that God doesn't have the ims. Like, just the whole fact that God acts in history. Acting takes change, and you have to change in order to act, so how could you be immutable? Now, there are fancy philosophical ways around this, but to me, it just seems more straightforward to think of your God as somebody who actually changes when he acts.
Well, that's very biblical.
And that's biblical. And actually responds to people, so that the responses turn out to be real, genuine relation, rather than something that was drummed up before the beginning of time. So there's ways in which the omnis and the ims kind of conflict with, at least on a normal reading, with the God of the Bible. And that's the biblical stuff really fast. But let me just say one quick thing, and then I'm going to let you go. This book, The Openness of God, has in it, it's introducing a slightly different theory than my theory in the end as far as a positive way of understanding who God is. But the beginning drum up is very similar to what I did in my dissertation, and it's in the bookstore. So chapter one is all the biblical stuff, and chapter two is all the historical stuff. So this, and it's really well done. So this would be one way to go if you're curious about the kinds of things I've said tonight.
When's your book coming out?
I have to write a book. But hopefully an article will come out soon. All right, thanks for coming.
Thank you.